Today we turn our attention to a man who lived more than 1,400 years ago, but whose teachings are as timely and relevant today as ever. He was a believer in oneness, a reluctant prophet, a lover of nature, a champion of women's rights, an advocate for the vulnerable, a joyful family man, and most of all, he was a man of God. His name was Muhammad. We are told that he was born around 570 of the Common Era in Mecca, Arabia, presumably or purportedly from noble lineage. Muhammad never knew his father because his father died when Muhammad's mother was just 2 months pregnant. And Muhammad's mother, Amina, had a vision during her pregnancy that her child would be the master of his people. And so when he was born, she named him Muhammad, which means the one who is worthy of praise. Well, after Muhammad was born, Amina sent him off for a few years to live with a Bedouin family. That was actually the custom in ancient Arabia, that they would send the children off to live with a family in the desert, a sort of a nomadic family for a few years in order to kind of learn the rigors of Arabian life. They would stay there and then they would be returned after a few years to their parents in the city. Well, Muhammad lived with his Bedouin family for 4 years before being returned to his mother. But only 2 years after he came home to Amina, she died. And so at the age of just 6, Muhammad was orphaned. Well, his grandfather took him in, had him live with him, but just 2 years later, he also died. And so from that point forward, Muhammad was raised by his uncle and his uncle's wife. You know, those early experiences, we can only imagine all that he went through in those early years of his life. But they had seemed to have had a lasting impression on him because he went through those times of loss and pain and vulnerability, that it made him all the more sensitive throughout his life to the plight of others, particularly the weak and vulnerable, and most especially orphans and women and the poor. We don't know if he had a formal education. However, Islamic tradition is emphatic in saying that he did not know how to read or write. However, he is reputed to have had a very fine memory and really outstanding, exemplary speaking skills, an ability to express very eloquently and articulate even difficult topics. And it is suggested that he may have learned some of those skills, some of those exemplary speaking skills from his time with his Bedouin family, because in that community, they had a very strong oral tradition, and they had magnificent, renowned poets and storytellers. So he may have begun to hone those skills at a very early age. And it is also thought that from his time in the desert, that sort of fostered his lifelong love of nature. Nature was often where he would go to pray. Well, when Muhammad was an adolescent, a Christian hermit named Bahira interpreted a growth of skin between the boy's shoulder blades as the seal of prophethood. And then around 590 of the Common Era, when Muhammad was just 20 years old, he attended an important tribal meeting and witnessed the negotiation of the Alliance of the Virtuous, one of the world's first human rights agreements. That event profoundly affected him. He appreciated certainly the foundational principles of fairness and equity, but he was particularly struck with the idea that a system of ethics could be affirmed by all people, regardless of their religious or ethnic background. Muhammad became so dedicated to fairness and honesty that he came to be known as the Trustworthy One. As a young adult, he worked as a shepherd and later as a trader, where his honesty attracted the attention of a caravan owner and twice widowed wealthy woman named Khadija. She is said to have been 40 when Muhammad was about 25. Well, Khadijah hired Muhammad to lead her caravans. She was very impressed by him, and soon she was smitten. She sent a friend to see if Muhammad might want to marry her. Muhammad said yes, but he was too poor to marry. Whereupon Khadijah invited Muhammad to come to her home and propose to him. You go, girl. I mean, 40-year-old proposing to a 25-year-old. He said yes. They were married 25 years until Khadijah's death. It was said to be a marriage of great love and devotion. They had 4 daughters and 2 sons. Both of the sons died young. And after Khadijah's death, Muhammad had many more wives, as polygamy was the norm in that culture. But he was reputed, known for treating all of his wives very fairly and equally. He had many more children, and he enjoyed family life and took a great pleasure out of being a husband and father. In 610 of the Common Era, during the month of Ramadan, Muhammad went off into nature to pray, as was his habit. And in the quiet on this day, he began receiving revelations. He heard the command, "Read." When he responded that he could not read, he felt as if he were being squeezed so violently that he could barely breathe. The force subsided, but then the whole process recurred 2 more times. Then Muhammad heard, "Read in the name of your Lord. He teaches man what he never knew." Well, he was a little freaked out by this episode, frightened for his life, and not knowing what else to do. Muhammad began to repeat the words that he'd heard. He rushed home to Khadijah, who assured him he was not possessed. And from the moment she heard his story, Khadijah was confident that the voice he heard was speaking words from God. In the beginning, Muhammad resisted the idea that God was calling him to be a prophet, but eventually he embraced his calling. After that first revelation, he received a few more, and then suddenly they just stopped. It was 2 more years before Muhammad heard the voice again, and this time it said, "Soon your guardian Lord will give you what shall make you content." Over the next 20 years, Muhammad received more than 100 revelations. Sometimes the voice was accompanied by a vision of the angel Gabriel, but often the revelation was an intense, sort of indescribable experience, which would then really call into play his eloquence, his ability to describe the indescribable. Muhammad said this, "Sometimes it comes to me," talking about the revelations, "sometimes it comes to me like the reverberations of a bell, and those are the hardest on me. The reverberations stop when I'm aware of their message. And sometimes the angel takes the form of a man and speaks to me, and I am aware of what he says." You know, Muhammad never claimed that his messages were unique. He insisted the message was as old as humankind, what he was receiving in these revelations. All that was different was the messenger, for God had sent a prophet to the Arabs. Muhammad's teachings launched the Islam. The word Islam means peace, launched the Islam movement, which at first was just his closest friends and family. But as the movement grew, it attracted strong and eventually violent opposition. So around 621 of the Common Era, so he would have been 51. In order to escape persecution, Muhammad migrated from Mecca to Medina in what is known as the Hijra. He stayed in Mecca for the rest of his life. So here's what he would do whenever he received a revelation, remembering that he couldn't read and write. He would commit the words to memory, and then he would recite them to others. A lot of repetition. Only after his death were these revelations actually written down, fully transcribed, and compiled into what became the Quran, the holy book of Islam. It includes the revelations that Muhammad received from the age of 40 till his death at the age of 63. The Quran has 114 chapters, or surahs, consisting of more than 6,000 verses. It's about similar in length to the New Testament. By the way, there's a second sacred book in Islam called the Hadith, and that consists of quotes and vignettes about Muhammad's life based on the oral tradition and written more than a century after his death. Though his revelations changed over time, Muhammad never departed from their basic message. That message was the singleness of Allah, and by the way, Allah means the God, and the principle of human equality. Muhammad said the fundamental character of ultimate reality was, listen to this, tawheed, or unity, oneness. That is the cornerstone of Islam. There is no God but God. You know, I pondered that as I was working on this. When we hear that, we think about there's no other deities, right? There's just one sort of supreme God. But if you really take that into your heart to mean not worshiping false gods in our own lives, false gods of money, fame, beauty, whatever it might be, other people, jobs, situations, well, it really sharpens the focus that there is no God but God. Muhammad further taught that all men and women are equal before God. He championed women's rights, and he gave women many safeguards that they hadn't had before, such as rights of property ownership, inheritance, and divorce. Muhammad also protected the lives of baby girls, strictly prohibiting female infanticide, which had been happening previous to him. According to Muhammad, the main human flaw, the main way we humans mess it up, is forgetting about God and our obligations as creatures of God. And so for that reason, if your main problem is forgetting, you can see why in Islam there's a heavy emphasis on remembrance and repetition. So the five pillars of Islam are the affirmation of faith, and that affirmation of faith is, I bear witness that there is no God but God, and that Muhammad is his messenger. The second pillar is prayer. Muslims are to pray 5 times a day, facing toward Mecca. The third is fasting, at least during the month of Ramadan, and hopefully more often. The fourth is generosity in giving. And the fifth is making a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in one's lifetime. Something I think that many people don't realize is that Muhammad had great respect for both Judaism and Christianity. He felt that in both of those religions, they were monotheistic, and so they were focused, even if they used different names, they were focused on the one God. Large parts of the Quran speak of the prophets and teachers of Judaism, particularly Abraham, Jacob, and Moses, as well as Jesus, who is seen as a great prophet, second only to Muhammad. Jesus is known in the Quran as Isa, I-S-A, the son of Maryam, and he's considered not only a messenger, but among the greatest of all human beings. According to the Quran, his mission was to bear witness to the oneness of God and the necessity of submitting to the divine will. There are hundreds of teachings in Islam about the life and message of Jesus. The Quran affirms his virgin birth and the miracles, but emphatically states Jesus was not the son or incarnation of God. In Islam, regarding Jesus as a son of God or as a divine incarnation would commit what is called shirk, S-H-I-R-K, which is the unpardonable sin of believing in and worshiping deities other than Allah. After Muhammad's death in 632 of the Common Era, the excitement around his dynamic new teachings spread throughout the Arabian Peninsula and beyond. The new religion was particularly popular for its belief in a purely transcendent God in place of numerous deities. It also appeased many Jews and Christians by incorporating key elements of their teachings. Over the centuries, Islam has continued to spread across the globe. Today, it is the second largest religion after Christianity and the fastest growing religion in the world. Muhammad himself and many Muslims today do not see Islam as a religion as much as an all-embracing way of life. Unity author John Paul Roach writes, "The great gift of Islam is its ability to integrate the divine into every aspect of society and human endeavor." Nevertheless, I would be remiss to not mention some of the many misconceptions today about Islam. For example, the clothing of Muslim women, particularly the hijab or veil, is sometimes seen as a sign of religious subjugation by men. But Islamic scholars say that it is simplistic and misleading. Both women and men are advised to dress modestly. Muhammad considered modesty and dress to reflect modesty in the heart. The Quran does not require veiling. The veiling was a pre-Islamic custom practiced by some Jewish as well as Christian women. Today, many Muslim women defend the veil because they find it helps deter unwanted sexual attention from men. Some have even resisted efforts in Western countries to force them to remove it in public. Different view, huh? Westerners also today sometimes associate Islam with radical Islamic terrorists. It is important to remember that every religion is subject to distortion by fringe factions and to not mistake this for the founders or the religion's core tenets. Muhammad was a proponent of peace, not of violence. Muslims have traditionally regarded Muhammad with tremendous affection and admiration. When they say or write his name, they follow it with the words, "Peace be upon him." The prophet is seen as the embodiment of the highest human qualities. Today, as we close out our series on Confucius, Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad, we are seeing many ways in which their lives overlap, although each was quite distinct. We can see that they shared certain commonalities. They were all born in a time of great turmoil and tremendous monumental change. Each and every one of them was connected to, aware of, the profound issues at play in their time. And each of them had a vision or a dream or a path for how to get through them. They all believed in living very simply and made a conscious choice to live simply, and they were absolutely devoted to their spiritual discipline. There is one other common practice among them that really stands out that indeed was central for them. They would each take time to go apart and be in the quiet, to be still, to turn within, to let the mind settle so that they could be receptive to whatever the universe wanted to teach them. You know, that is particularly evident in the lives of the Buddha and Muhammad. The Buddha, remember, sat under the Bodhi tree and had his awakening through meditation, and certainly Muhammad with his 100 or however many it was revelations as he would turn within. That was life-changing for him and actually world-changing. So when we hear stories like that, we might tend to wonder, how can I hear the voice of God? How can I have a divine messenger come to me? So there's a wonderful story at the end of the course on Confucius, Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad that's in the Great Courses, where I have drawn a great deal of my material for this series. And Professor Mark Muse offers this story toward the end of the class. It seems that George Bernard Shaw wrote a play late in his life about Joan of Arc, in which she claims to hear voices from God. Late in the play, when King Charles is interrogating her on suspicion of heresy, he asks, "Why don't the voices come to me? I am king, not you." And Joan replies, "They do come to you, but you do not hear them. You have not sat in the field in the evening listening for them. When the Angelus bell rings, you cross yourself and have done with it. But if you prayed from your heart and listened to the thrilling of the bells in the air after they stop ringing, you would hear the voices as well as I do." You see, we can take to heart the lessons of these ancient sages by remembering to take time apart, to truly listen, to slow ourselves down, to go within, and then pay attention to what is revealed to us about what is truly important in life. We too can be filled with God. In truth, we are filled with God. We just don't know it. We can sense the fullness of God within us. We can follow the examples of these amazing four ancient sages to live life to the fullest, to understand it at depth, and to face it with faith and with courage. And with that, let's prepare for our meditation. Comfortable in your seat. Take a nice big deep breath in. Close your eyes if you wish. Feet on the floor, feeling the good Mother Earth beneath you. Take a big breath in and let go. And one more time, breathing in deeply and release. Just allow yourselves to take in these words from the opening chapter of the Quran, Surah 1, which sums up the relationship between God and humankind. In the name of God, the merciful Lord of mercy, praise be to God, the Lord of all being, the merciful Lord of mercy, master of the day of judgment. You alone we serve, and to you alone we ask for help. Guide us in the straight path, the path of those whom you have blessed, not of those who have earned displeasure or those who have gone astray. Take a moment to just breathe in this presence of God that is enfolding you in this very minute, that is moving in and through every cell of your being. One suggestion I've heard for connecting to the voice of the divine is to ask a question that you would ask to a great spiritual master. Hold that question in your mind. Speak it to yourself as if asking the spiritual master, and then just listen. Listen for the response. Not in a hurry, but with patience. Listen, and listen some more. I invite you to speak whatever question might be on your mind today, whatever need you may have. Send it out into the divine, and listen in the silence. Remind ourselves that we can repeat this process anytime we are feeling overwhelmed, confused, or in any way of need of reassurance and comfort, that we can go apart within ourselves, even if we're present in a group. We can turn within, breathe, quiet our minds, and open our hearts. The great lessons that we've learned in this series from these amazing spiritual masters who came before us, we're so grateful. We're so grateful that on a spirit level they are still with us, leading us forward. And we say thank you, God. And so it is. Amen.
Flow, Spirit, flow through me as I open up to be an expression of your unfolding.